Thanks to our taxpayers. So I welcome you to come out. And I'm going to introduce Richie Henderson, who is the moderator of the league, and who will introduce me.
Thank you very much. My name is Keith Henderson, and I'm from the League of Women Voters of South San Mateo County. The League of Women Voters is a nonpartisan organization. We don't support either candidates or political parties. But our mission is to encourage the participation of active, informed citizens in their government as people. And this forum, which is sponsored by the League of Women Voters, the Mid-Peninsula Community Media Center, and Kanata College, is for U.S. Congressional District 14. This is the House of Representatives, our federal government. And with us today are three candidates, starting at the far end, Brian Holst from the Libertarian Party, Anna Eshoo from the Democratic Party, and Chris Coggin from the Republican Party. Our this morning will be that each of the candidates will have 3 minutes to make an opening statement. And then we will begin the questions which have been given to me from students. If you still have questions you would like to ask, please raise your hand. We will try and make sure that we get any additional things that are coming from you. After the questions, the candidates will each have 1 minute to make a statement, and they will have a minute to answer your questions. And again, they will each have a second to chat at 1 minute to speak. We have a timekeeper here who will indicate to the candidate when there's 30 seconds left or 15 seconds, and then raise a red card or something. So let's begin with the questions. I'm going to start with a question that will be directed to Chris Coggin.
Do you have opening statements first?
Oh, sorry. Did I? Yes.
You can't have an opening statement.
I can't have an opening statement. Oh. Chris, would you please make your opening statement?
Okay, well, thank you very much, Missy. It's wonderful to be here, and I appreciate the League of Women Voters for doing this. This is a beautiful theater, and I commend all of you folks for showing up here during your lunch hour. It's really something, and it's very important to carefully assess who you send to Washington, because the actions there do affect lives and the lives of the whole country. So I congratulate you for being here and for that effort. You notice that a lot of people don't make that effort. It's hard. Let me, first of all, just tell you briefly things about myself. I am a lifelong Bay Area resident, raised in Berkeley, and then came down here to go to Stanford, where I met my wife 36 years. We raised two children who both went to Stanford. And I was a civil engineer for 5 years, and then started being involved with high school kids working in various works with Young Life on the peninsula. And most recently, about 11 years ago, my wife and I found a private Christian high school down in Sunday called the King's Academy, which has 730 kids, which is working very well. Now, in 1992, when Anna Eshoo first went to Washington, I started to find out how she was voting on things. The rest of my representatives, Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein, and I said very many times they were voting in exact contradiction to the values that I hold important. So, and it was easy right then to follow the votes because the Mercury News would put those in the newspaper every week. But it's hard, so you have to go to extra work to find out how your representative is representing. Now, I think today there are three main issues, and they all start with the letter T. One of them is terrorism, one of them is taxes, and one of them is teachers, plus education. And terrorism, that's the big one, because we are at war, and it's not sure whether the choice is war or peace. It's we are at war, or we're going to see the total destruction of our way of life. And I think even all of Western civilization is at stake. So this is a way we must win. And that's the key to that is something you could see from me. And judging from voting record, I don't think that's a commitment we can see from Hannah. The second issue is taxes. And the difference between Hannah and me is Hannah is has been voting. She voted against the Bush tax cuts and has voted for various other taxes throughout her career. And the third thing is teachers. And I think the less the federal government imposes regulation on us, and less our local teachers and schools innovate, the better we'll do. Thank you.
Our second speaker is going to be Brian.
Hi, my name is Brian Holtz. I'm a software engineer at Yahoo and Dell. I live in San Carlos with my wife and two young daughters. I'm here today to spread the word about intelligent alternative to the tired old divisions between Democrats on the left and Republicans on the right. The Democrats and the Republicans have kind of a schizophrenic idea of how to balance security and liberty. The Democrats favor civil liberty, but they also favor economic security. Republicans, on the other hand, favor civil security, but economic liberty. We libertarians favor both civil liberty and economic liberty. So another way to look at this is that the Democrats want the government to be your nanny. The Republicans want government to be your chaperone. We libertarians want the government to treat you like a grown-up and to just be our referee and our lifeguard. So, but some people say, why vote for a third party? It's way to vote. But your vote isn't going to tip the outcome of the election. Actually, has this election pretty much sewn up. Your vote is for standing up for what you need. If you really believe that the Democratic Party is not living enough, then vote for the Greens or Peace and Freedom. If you think the Republican Party is not right-wing enough, vote for the Constitution Party or an independent. And if you think you agree with the Reform Party this morning, then just wait till this afternoon because it's going to change. But if you believe that left-wing and right-wing are both half-wrong, then vote Libertarian to stand up for that belief. Vote Libertarian to stand up for the idea of individual liberty and individual responsibility. Vote Libertarian for free market solutions to the 21st century's problem related to the environment, healthcare, retirement security, education. I'm so confident in these solutions that I'll make a bet with any registered voter in my district right here, right now. If you can go to my website and read enough about the Libertarian solutions to pass a short quiz on solutions, and you can still say you won't vote for me, then I'll mail you $2. It's the only kind of advertising I'm willing to buy. So go to marketliberal.org, take the quiz. If you still don't like it, you'll get your $2. Otherwise, go to smartvoter.org and evaluate the Libertarian alternative, not only in this race, but in all the races on your ballot. Thank you for your attention and to all the volunteers who made this forum possible.
Thank you. Anna, you're the third one.
Thank you very much. First of all, to the League of Women Voters who make all this possible. I think were it not for the League, we simply would not have these debates, not only throughout our area, but all over California and certainly across the country. So I salute you for your public service. I'm thrilled that we're here at Convention, and I want to thank your president, Rosa. I love men presidents, for hosting us here today, to all the students that are here. Kenyatta is a very special place to me because I was a student here and graduated from Kenyatta. Kenyatta has given much to me, and I never, ever forget that. I'm running for re-election to the House of Representatives, and I hope that today you will have a better sense walking out of what the major issues are that our country faces and the directions that I think we should be taking our country in. So I want to talk to you about three major issues that have really dominated this Congress. War in Iraq, national security, and our economy. In 2002, when President Bush's war resolution was brought to the floor of the House, I debated against it. I did not believe that the Bush doctrine of prison, of first strike, and unilateralism, the best departure from established foreign policy of our great country, was the right policy. We invaded, we have lost over 1,000 American lives. And I think we need to be asking ourselves if this was absolutely necessary. As a member of the House Intelligence Committee, I have seen firsthand that there is not a shred of intelligence that linked Saddam Hussein, the attack on our country, and Al-Qaeda. And so while we are, of course, better off with Saddam Hussein gone, Should not we have had the weapons inspectors remain and complete job and do the proper diplomacy rather than to be in the quagmire that I believe we are in now? Never before has the standing of the United States of America been so low around the world, and we still have the alerts that we have. The real effort is global terrorism. Iraq has taken our eye off of the main ball. The economy, I believe, has faltered, and my opponent has brought up the Bush tax cuts. My friends, the Bush tax cuts have caused 70% national deficit and debt that you are now burdened with. Instead of you walking out of here today with a national policy that favors people, that invests in their future, I believe that we are moving in the wrong direction. So I want you to know that I do fight for those funds that are critical for community colleges across our country to make the investments that are going to pay off for our collective future. Research and development, education for all of our people, an environment that is protected and revered, and a nation and a world at peace. I look forward to answering your questions.
Thank you. We are now going to take some of the questions which you submitted, and you're going to see that they range all over from very small items to large items. The first one is, do you think that the voting age should be lowered or raised? There's been talk about lowering it, and there's been talk about raising it up again to 21. Why or why not do you feel that way? And I am going to start with Brian.
Certainly shouldn't be raised. 18 is certainly old enough to figure out where you stand and where your interests are. And like Anna said, young people are really facing a lot of burdens that the older generations are putting on them. If you look at my flyer outside, I break down how each and every one of you, including my daughter, born last year, are already $94,000 in debt, thanks to unfunded government liabilities and government debt. And these are due not only to Republican tax cuts, these are also due to Democratic entitlement programs that make promises that Congress isn't willing to pay for. So I don't want to see this, the age raised. Lowered, I don't see it as needing to be lowered either.
Thank you. Anne?
Well, I think if you can get a driver's license when you're 16 years old, I think it would be wonderful to open up and lower the voting age. When I was a little younger than you, you had to be 21 years old to vote. And we saw a newfound activism and an interest, a vested interest in our country when the age for voting was lowered. But I do think that what you're going to have to demonstrate is that young people turn out in greater and greater numbers. That will embolden lawmakers to say, well, if we have so many coming out at the age of 18 and 19 years old, imagine how you would enhance our participatory democracy at 16. So I do favor it. I think it would be wonderful. The more people becoming informed and acting on that in our democracy, the better off we are.
Okay, thank you. Mr.
Howard. Yeah, you can drive a car at age 16, therefore you should be able to vote 16 as a non sequitur. That argument doesn't make any sense. They're entirely different skills. But the argument was earlier that we can be drafted at age 18, therefore we should be able to vote at age 18. And that did give it quite a big upsurge in the number of young people voting. But that's dropped off over the years. Now, from the 18 to 25 age group, only about 20% of the people vote. Isn't that something? And are we bothering to get informed on the issues? Being informed and then voting is a key. We don't want to just go vote for voting's sake. But I urge all the kids at our school to get informed and vote. Our graduates have a much higher voting rate than that, but 18 is fine.
Thank you. Next question has already been spoken to briefly, but not directly. You have the ability to help shape foreign policy. What is your individual stance on the war? How would you go about bringing the truth out of Iraq? I'm going to start with Anna.
Well, I think you already know my position about the war and why I opposed it. Now we are there, and so I think that these are the following things. While we don't know whether they will work, and what I want to say to the young people that are here, once our country has subjected itself to this, that we are so heavily implicated in this, no one should fool you and say that there's a magic bullet and that it will be easy to get out. I think the following things should be considered, because it would help change the policy. For one, I think the United States should lead in urging countries that hold the greatest debt that Iraq has to eliminate that, so that the Iraqi people know that we are really on their side, that we pledge to the Iraqi people that all the contracts that have been let, so many of them, to Halliburton without any kind of public bidding whatsoever, that those contracts be opened up to the Iraqi people so that they can help build up their own economy. Number three, that the oil that they have belongs to them, and that we did not go into Iraq simply because she is a nation that holds the second largest amount of oil in the world. Number four, that a new president will immediately get onto Air Force One and go around the world and meet the world's leaders to help bring them along and be part of the solution, because we all have a vested interest in it. Why? Because it is a troubled part of the world. So I think that those are some of the things that we can do. But we are now paying the price, American lives and the American treasury, for going into a post-war Iraq without a plan. It is the cost of the arrogance of this administration.
Thank you. Ryan, would you speak to this, please?
Sure. First of all, I want to say that the Libertarian Party is four square against intervention abroad, and I'm somewhat of a maverick within my party in that I don't necessarily agree that the government's purpose of defending human liberty stops completely at our nation's borders. As getting out of Iraq, there's actually not, now that we're in, there's not a lot of disagreement on how and whether we need to work our way out. So I will say, though, that I supported the war in Iraq, not because of WMDs. I'm glad we didn't find them, because it's forced the administration to recognize that this is really more of a humanitarian issue. I mean, Saddam was a guy who had killed 2 million people in two different wars that he started. He'd invaded one neighbor and another. He fired ballistic missiles at two others. He defied UN disarmament things. And we had existence proofs that could make us optimistic. Kurdistan has been stable and free under our protection for the last 10 years. Afghanistan has been relatively stable since we liberated it. So there, some degree of optimism was justifiable. It may not be working out that well, but let's get out in a stable way.
Let's move on to the next question.
Did Chris?
Oh, I'm sorry. I marked down the order. I'm trying to rotate among you, and so please speak to those.
Yeah. I listened to Anna talk on television about this issue recently, and it just sounded to me like it did just now that she fears President Bush more than she does Osama bin Laden. Thinks he would do us more harm. We are at war. Big time with someone who has declared war against us and will stop at nothing to destroy, would like to destroy millions of Americans. We've seen their actions with Eddings recently. We've seen what they did on 9/11. And this is a serious enemy, and our commander-in-chief and our soldiers have been doing a fabulous job about going after this thing. If President Bush hadn't gone after Afghanistan early on when this happened and responded the way he did, we would have seen many more attacks here in the United States since then. And all the fighting is being done in Iraq right now, which is a whole lot better than around here. And unilaterally, these words just keep throwing out. We're making this thing hysterical. We have 34 nations working with us here. We don't have France and Germany and Russia, but would we ever? Thank you.
This next question has to do with immigration. Would you do anything about illegal immigration if you were elected, or leave it unchecked and uncontrolled? I'm going to ask Anna to speak to that first.
Well, one of the top priorities, responsibilities of the Congress of the United States is to guard our borders. And I don't think that there's any question in most people's minds that we have not done the best job absolutely possible. And it is the border issue is referred to more in terms of the Mexican-American border than it is the Canadian border, most frankly. Over the years, I have voted for additional guard patrols to give those patrols the equipment, the high technology that they need. So there isn't any question that we need to do a much better job of controlling our borders. But there is the issue once people have come into this country. And it is highly controversial, but I want you to know where I am. I see many people contribute to our economy every single day. And I believe that it's time for us to look at that, to understand it, to appreciate it, and to build a program where people who have an absolutely perfect record relative to law enforcement, where they have been contributors over a long period of time, that we bring them onto the glide path of citizenship.
Okay, thank you very much. Then next, I'd like to ask Brian.
Okay. The Libertarian Party is in favor of immigration. We believe that immigration makes the country stronger. I differ a little bit with the party in that I think liberty is so powerful in building prosperity, and when it's absent or diminished abroad, it hurts their economy so much that makes a country as free as America be an incredible magnet for people. So I wouldn't have completely unlimited immigration. I would try to restrict it, maybe to try to get people in who have better skills, who can contribute more to the economy than people who are just coming here to sort of for other reasons. However, don't be misled thinking that illegal immigrants are causing any kind of big drain on our public resources. It's minuscule. In fact, poverty programs themselves are a much smaller slice of the budget than government entitled programs, for middle class people. The problems that we have are due to politicians cutting checks to middle class Americans. They're not due to poor people or to immigrants.
Thank you. Chris?
Well, I just don't understand that. California figures school educating illegal immigrants costs California $2 billion a year. That seems like somewhat of a drain. I'm for immigration also. I don't understand what our immigration policy is right now. I met a lady who has a ranch down on the Arizona-Mexico border, and she says that 2,000 people cross her property every night. 2,000 every night. And that 25% of them, they checked it out, are other than Mexican. So it's coming from Asia, and the Middle East, and further south in South America, in Central America. That's an astounding worry about our national security. The operative word in the whole thing is illegal, and we're for immigration, where somebody comes to this country and does, plays by the rules. But the illegal thing is the problem there, and very few career politicians in Congress have any backbone to do anything about it.
Thank you. Very few, quite a different issue. What is your position on the dispute about eliminating the phrase "under God" from the Pledge of Allegiance? Would you vote for it to be removed, or will you vote to keep it in? And I'd like to start with Brian.
I'll take it out. It was put in the 1950s as part of the Red Scare. Communism is atheism, and therefore we need to, emphasize the difference. But it pretty much goes against the spirit, if not perhaps even the letter of the First Amendment. the sacrament of religion. So it's just take it out.
Good. Certainly keep it right in there. That's not a religious thing. That's our heritage of our country. The whole Declaration of Independence the argument there is that we're endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, and that was a recognition of what our country's founding principles were. And you take that out, the whole effort's been now is to just officiate all the power that our founding fathers put into our founding documents, and I would really object to seeing that taken out.
I support it. I think it should be in. I love the Pledge of Allegiance, and it's an important part of it, and I have voted to uphold it. I think the issue here for the students, in case you don't know, is someone challenged that, and it was challenged in the Ninth Circuit, which struck it down. The Supreme Court then took the case and reinstated, and so Under God is safely contained in the Pledge of Allegiance. But this last week in the Congress, last Thursday, September 23rd, my Republican colleagues, ignoring the fact that that case was won, in the name of Under God, removed all judicial review in our country. Now, that's not going to stand in the Senate, but to show you to what extent people will go to be absurd and to twist something into a political pretzel, I think that really demonstrated. That's a very, very dangerous precedent to try to set, that the courts not have judicial review. In other words, you don't like what you pretend or you think, that the court is going to come down with something that you don't like. So let's strike the role of the courts. I don't think anyone here would be comfortable with that. And of course, I voted against it.
Thank you. We're going to switch again to the economy. What is your view of the present economy? Do you feel America is in an economic recovery? And if not, why not? What kind of policies would you create to support economic recovery? And I'm going to start with Chris.
Well, if the economy is in a recovery by all measures that are out there, one of the things that helped cause the economy to start bouncing back was a relief of a little bit of the taxation that has been imposed on our country. It was the Tax Foundation does a statistic every year that called Tax Relief Day. That's the day that you up to May 13th, you work every single day just to pay taxes. And that has gone back down to April 13th in 2004. And that what you tax, you discourage. And what we've had now is less taxes. So businesses have been, small businesses especially, have been more encouraged to make new jobs and make new investments.
Well, in brief, I believe that the Bush administration and its policies have made a mess of our national economy. Let me put some numbers out for you to consider. No president since Herbert Hoover, no president has lost the number of jobs that this administration has. We are still in a hole by 1.7 million jobs to climb back up to return to where the Bush administration took over from the Clinton administration. They inherited a $250 billion surplus. That was cash in the bank. They not only squandered that, but they brought forward tax cuts directed, and I have voted for tax cuts for the middle class. I support them. I think they're important. If we don't have a strong middle class, we don't have very much going for us in this country. But those tax cuts were targeted to the top 1.5% of the country. And what's happened? What's happened? Instead of putting cash in the average person, working person's pocket, we now have the largest deficit in the history of our nation and an almost $7 trillion swing in our national debt. That is a mess in terms of economy. What should we be doing? We should be investing in you, in education, which is dynamic, offering education to everyone that wants it in this country. And I'm going to go back to that when we're asked further questions, because there's so much to say about our nation's economy.
Brian?
The economy is pretty well known to be in recovery. There is a business cycle. Recessions happen from time to time. This one is a lot like the 1992 recovery in that it's a productivity-led recovery. That means companies are getting more out of the people there. People are being more productive rather than hiring new people on. A lot of that has to do with government policies that discourage hiring because we make your doctor, your employer be your doctor and your dentist and now your optometrist and all kinds of things. The way you do things with economic policies, you don't try to fight the business cycle. The government is not nimble enough to do that. Instead, you put in place the right long-term policies, and then the economy will take care of itself.
Thank you. Again, switching topics. Do you stand by the recent congressional decision regarding homosexual marriage? I think they're talking about the federal marriage amendment vote. And if not, how can you make yourself heard in the House of Representatives if you were elected? And I'm going to start with Ryan.
I support that marriage should be available to gays and lesbians, and people regardless of their gender preference, period.
That's quick. Chris?
Well, the term marriage means between a man and a woman. That's what the term has meant for thousands and thousands of years. And to suddenly change the definition of that by our courts is obscene. We get to get courts in there to make this decision. This should be worked out through the legislative process and with a full open debate and consideration of it. But I personally think that when we start to look at that situation, we'll want to protect marriage in the United States. This is the Scandinavian countries are way ahead of us in this respect, if this is ahead. And in parts of Norway, 80% of children are born in families where the parents are not married. It just wipes out the whole thinking process of young people to ever get married in the first place. That's what's happened in the Scandinavian countries. And we need to protect our families as a basic unit here in the United States.
I will not vote for a constitutional amendment that prohibits the unions of men and women. Women to a woman to a woman, a man to a man. And let me tell you why. This is a constitutional issue. When we take our oath of office, we vote to uphold the Constitution of the United States of America. Never in our history have we placed anything in the Constitution that takes away the rights of individuals. Our Constitution and our history demonstrate that we add to it, expand the rights from generation to generation of the American people. So I think it's wrong-headed, and I also think that it is cruel because it doesn't recognize the fullness of citizenship of all of our people. I think we're all God's children. These are civil marriages. They are not dispensing. The state is not dispensing a sacrament. It cannot. Only churches can do that. So I do not support a constitutional amendment that would infringe on and diminish the rights of American citizens. And that's what this is.
Thank you. Everyone is worried about the amount of money going into political campaigns, and there have been several efforts to control that. What measures do you think should be taken? And I'm going to start with Anna.
Well, I've worked long and hard on campaign finance reform. When I first went to the Congress, I had my own particular plan After a while, I realized that any, just about any kind of reform was better than none at all, because I saw firsthand every week in being with my constituents. I fly across the country every week, come home to be with my constituents, that it was really striking at the heart of democracy. Too many people believe that their vote doesn't count, and money is the issue that gets in the way. It was a struggle to bring about and have the president sign the McCain-Feingold legislation, but like so many other pieces of legislation, there is a loophole in it, and we see it today with 527, the independent organizations that raise money, and you see a lot of TV ads. So I think that this is an ongoing effort. I do favor public funding of federal campaigns. I think it is the only and best way, finally, to get socks on the octopus of money in politics.
Chris?
Yep. The McCain-Feingold bill has sometimes been called an incumbent protection plan. It's the several people in the Congress thought that that would that's an infringement on the First Amendment, our free speech to it prohibited that and restricted it, and they thought that the president won't sign it. And I heard that the president signed it thinking that the Supreme Court would chop it down. But none of those things happened, and now it's the law of the land. And it's we didn't hear Democrats screaming about the 527s until the Swift boat vets came out, but because they're taking great advantage of this money, this money that we don't even know about. I think it's just fine to have for our First Amendment rights to have contributions from individuals, as long as we have complete disclosure of that, so that when you see somebody raking in a lot of money for a campaign, you know exactly where it came from.
Thank you. Brian?
I don't think there's too much money in politics. These guys have a lot more donations than me, and that's fine. People are free to give to whatever candidate they want, whatever party they want. If we all had the same amount of funding, I think I'd clean their clocks. So they need the fundraising advantage. But I think the answer to any problem of speech is more speech. If we're upset at how much speech is happening in the form of campaign spending, then the kind of reforms I would only consider would be things where next to each person's name on the ballot, let's put a total of how much fundraising they got. If you saw how much they had compared to the others, then you might think twice about who to vote for. Same with political advertising. Make sure each commercial says who paid for it. You know, just like the new rule about, I'm George Bush and I paid for this message. As long as you put sunshine into the system, then let people vote with their put their money where their mouth is and let the chips fall where they may.
Thank you. The Patriot Act is coming up for renewal soon, and this has been a major issue for debate. And what is your position on the renewal of the Patriot Act? And I'm going to start with.
Well, I think that it has been a short lesson for our country to see how the administration has actually carried out so many parts of the Patriot Act that was passed shortly after our country was attacked. There are provisions, as you know, in the Patriot Act that allow the federal government to follow what you read, what you buy in stores, what you take out in libraries. I've offered legislation to strike that section. There has been an abuse, I believe, of our civil liberties and our civil rights on that. Under the set of circumstances that we have experienced so far, I will not support what the administration sends forward. Why? Because it is ever more intrusive and dangerous. We can secure our national security with homeland and hometown security and all it takes to take care of our country, without violating our civil liberties and our civil rights under the Constitution of the United States. This administration only knows one part of that.
Thank you. Brian?
Oh, the Patriot Act, as I understand it, is like an inch or two thick, and there's no place in for laws that big. So I would throw it out on just that basis alone. Civil libertarians have a lot of serious concerns about the Patriot Act, and I share those concerns. I don't think the sky is falling. I mean, there's some stuff in there that is really, really scary sounding, mm-hmm. and it could be the beginning of a slippery slope. But I think slippery slope arguments, you have to kind of take them with a grain of salt. So, yeah, throw it out, try again, nice try. The sky isn't really falling. This country is way too much a freedom-loving country to ever let stuff like this get out of hand. But you've got to be vigilant, and that means, starting over on this.
Okay, thank you. There's quite a bit of discussion about dependence on
water. Did Chris get a chance?
Well, I'm sorry.
I just put it up here.
That's number three, and I realized...
Put me down.
Okay. And you thought it was good to sit next to her.
I'm certainly glad that you're revisiting it. There's been a lot of criticism of it, and that's a hard balance to make between our national security at this point and letting our intelligence agencies... finding people that are meaning to do us harm, while at the same time protecting the rest of it, that's a delicate balance. And I'm sure that it is all possible that some things got in there in the haste of getting that going that should be revisited. So I'm in favor of that.
Wait, I'm going to start with you this day. There's been quite a bit of talk about America's dependence on foreign oil and how this affects our foreign policy. What would you do if I like to decrease that dependence on foreign oil?
Well, I ride a bicycle a lot. That's the start with it. We have a great dependency on automobiles, and that's always just traveling around the Bay Area. It's all clogged up, and I imagine most people would like to find some kind of employment closer to that network. But we are dependent on cars for a significant amount. There's been great progress made in that with more fuel-efficient cars, and that's a plus, and we need to keep heading in that direction. Also, we need to open up some oil possibilities here at home, and I think that there's the hysteria about you have to protect every single spot in the whole country, no matter where you would think about having some oil exploration and production. Raises that hysteria, but I think we need some common sense approaches to that. The alternative to that is to send an awful lot of money to finance terrorist supporting regimes throughout the world.
Thank you.
Thank you. In order to wean ourselves off of a fossil fuel dependent society, we have to, and this can't only be done by the states. California has taken the lead, and I think the state legislature, I see Assemblyman Joe Simidian is here, should be saluted for that. But at the national level, what I have attempted to do at the Energy and Commerce Committee, where I'm a member, is to shape a national energy policy that really speaks to our future. And that is to create fuel-efficient standards for the American fleet of automobiles. Unless and until we do that, we will not move away from where we are now. We fight wars for countries that have oil. They don't have broccoli fields there. That's not why we are there. We have a vested interest in that. And so unless and until we embrace a policy that is going to take us into the future, we are less dependent on fossil fuels, where we make much better use of biomass and wind mass and green technologies, most frankly, an administration that shaped an energy policy in secret, and we see where we are today. Without a national energy policy, we can do so much better.
Brian?
The question was about the dependency on foreign oil, and we have dependency on foreign, probably, molybdenum and zinc and who knows what else. The people who have oil, in a free world, are going to sell it to people who want to buy it. That's how an independent world works. I think that we've got a strategic petroleum reserve that we have like a 6-month buffer or so against any possible boycott or something. But there's so many different countries that have plenty of oil that are perfectly willing to sell it. Nigeria, Russia. I think the issue regarding oil is not its source, but rather what we do with it. We burn a lot of it in our cars, and we cause a lot of pollution, and what we need to do is what economists call internalizing the externalities. We need to, instead of writing rules in Washington, D.C. about, you know, this is a light truck, so it's going to have this many miles per gallon, that's a car, so it'll have that many miles per gallon, instead we just need to tax oil and gas so that the price that it inflicts on the environment is built into its price at the pump. Then the free market will figure out what is the best way for people to use gas or its alternatives.
Thank you. We are now too short in time to go to another question, so I'm going to go to the candidates' opportunities to speak, and I'm going to expand to a minute and a half because that will just fit our timeline here. So I'm going to ask Brian to start with his summary.
Okay. Well, one issue that hasn't come up here that I'd like to emphasize a little bit is the issue of federalism. There's a tendency for politicians to want to do good really badly, and so whenever they see a problem, they want to be in charge of solving it. So what you have is a situation where I can see, you know, the school is going to be my daughter's classroom from the back window of my house, but for some reason, you know, very well-intentioned politicians think that our tax dollars need to take a 3,000-mile vacation over to Washington, D.C. in order to come back to that school and do things for that school that somehow our county or our state can't do for itself. So I'm not sure why the federal government is in charge of financing so many things. Maybe we're getting a lot of money out of Guam or the Virgin Islands or something. I'm not sure, but it just doesn't make sense to me. And also, the politicians in Washington, you know, are playing this shell game where they will tax your neighbor to try and buy your vote, and they'll tax you to try and buy your neighbor's vote, and hope neither of you, you know, will notice. And I think that what we need to do is we need to start from a clean sheet of paper and look at what government's good at and what government's not good at, and limit government to just the things that it's good at and it's needed for. And so that's why I want you to consider the libertarian alternative to the major parties of left and right. Thanks.
Thank you. Chris Hellman.
Now, I don't know what this left-right is, Brian. As I'm listening to you talk about the concept of federalism, that's something I subscribe to totally, the 10th Amendment to the Constitution. I signed a statement, took an oath, that I would defend and uphold the Constitution. It says that the federal government is limited to the functions that it says in the Constitution, and it's not supposed to go take on a bunch of other roles. And as it does that, there are all those other roles it takes on, which is just not good. And you mentioned the education money going to Washington. You don't want Washington, D.C., the federal government, to control your decisions for your schools. They're not good at it, and they have control over the Washington, D.C. schools, and they're arguably the schools in the country. In fact, parents and kids in Washington, D.C. schools want to get out of them real badly. Anna voted several times to deny those kids the opportunity to have a voucher to go to a different school. And she said, just keep them in those schools. When the federal government, and probably part of the problem is people go into office like that and become career politicians, and that way they lose touch with their decision-making revolves in large part around what will advance my career and make things work for me. Rather than being normal citizens the way that our founding fathers envisioned, that we would go to Washington for a little bit of time, serve, and then come back to being normal citizens. So I hope you'll consider that another thing.
Anna,
the
final statement.
I want to, express my thanks to the League of Women Voters, to all of the students and the faculty that are here today at Kenyatta, and to the people that are listening in to this debate. Of course, I hope I have earned your support, because I believe that I speak and am a voice for the values of the people of this congressional district. Whether a Republican or a Democrat has represented this district, the enduring values of this area have always been education and the environment. I'm proud of my record in the Congress to expand our open space here, to protect the environment not only here, but across our country. to invest in education, because that is the golden key to the future of the prosperity of our country. And I do that by fighting for the funds that would come for tuition to help you during very difficult times. But today the challenge in our country is enormous. And I've outlined those challenges. Whether we have an economy that is going to work for everyone, an international policy that is going to restore the greatness and the goodness and respect of our nation, and accountability to all of our citizens instead of piling up debt on our children and our grandchildren. These are the policies that I have fought for. I hope that you will cast a very informed vote and take our country in a new and better direction. And I hope when you go to vote that I will have earned your support. Thank you very much.
Thank you all. I want to remind you that the videotaping of this forum has been funded by the Peninsula Community Foundation. And you can see it again broadcast on the Peninsula Community Media Channels in Menlo Park, Atherton, and East Palo Alto several times before the November 2nd election. And it's also going to be shown on Peninsula TV local access channels. So that if you have friends who did not see it, they'll have an opportunity to do this. Last day to vote, to register to vote, is October 18th. You must be 18 by